aboard the station continued to trouble him, but in order to explore that more fully, he needed his strength in the Force. Meditation was a necessary prelude to action. Carefully, he noted the positions of every other person assigned to the vessel. Reeth and Dez on the station with Leox, Orla in the mess, Affy resting in her bunk, Geode apparently in charge of the bridge, before seeking a place of quiet and privacy. He found it in the very back of the ship, in front of a sealed-off cargo container. Interesting that the vessel crew would apologize so often for the smallness of their makeshift quarters, while still reserving so much space for cargo they hadn't even mentioned. Komak laid down his heavy blanket, folded into a kind of meditation mat, then knelt on it.
"I behold the world within myself," he thought. "I behold the world without myself."
The mantra had helped soothe him for many years. He liked the balance of it, but it had become too literal now to serve as a mantra.
"I am a Jedi. I have always been one. It is my identity, one I have never sought to change. But the Order does not answer the questions that linger within me. The questions only grow over time. Darkness abides upon this station. It is too familiar to me now. But the shape it takes here is different and unsettling. Consciousness without a corporeal being. What created this? How did the dark side take form in this place? How does the dark side take form anywhere? Sometimes I think we, the Jedi, must be somehow to blame. We who refuse to look at the Force in full, to examine the darkness as well as the light.
If the dark side were not so alien to them, Komak suspected, they would more readily understand the nature of the idols.
How can we split the Force in two? How can we justify such an act of violence? And it is violence, such a dividing. Even the darkness divided from the light.
Affy gave Leox all the credit for getting their fellow refugees to calm down, but she had to admit the Jedi were quick to give everyone a common goal, namely penetrating the lower rings of the station. That goal happened to neatly match her own. They'd accepted her report on the upper rings easily enough, which was fine because her report was true. It was not, however, the whole truth. Affy was keeping the smuggler's code and her thoughts about it to herself for the time being. "It makes zero sense for this to be a regular Bind Guild portal," she reasoned as she prepared to head down to the lower rings with the rest of the volunteers. Reeth, Nan, Dez, and a long-limbed Mizzy who, like all Mizzy, preferred to be nameless to strangers.
"It's out of the way, and it doesn't have any obvious advantages. But what if there's a secret society within the guild, one that's operating behind Scover's back? They could be skimming off the top, stealing small amounts of cargo or money, falsifying records to hide it from management. The pre-programmed location could have been downloaded from another ship, one that's in on it."
She didn't have to ask whether Leox was in on it. He would never. As angry as that theory made Affy, it was by far the most plausible she'd come up with.
Scover wouldn't hide something like this from her, so somebody had to be hiding things from Scover.
Her chest swelled with pride as she imagined finding the proof, presenting it to Scover, hearing her say, "Well done, daughter."
"All right," said Dez Rydan, bringing her back to the present.
The scouting party stood around him near the entrance to the lower ring. They all wore their own versions of utility gear, except for the Jedi, whose workaday garb seemed good for all occasions.
"We can't get any specific readings on what might be down there, only that it's not solid metal. If it's storage, there may be items of use to us, which will be equally shared among the entire group. As long as everyone understands that and accepts the risks, let's get started."
"Should you do this?"
Wreath quietly asked Nan, who barely came up to the Mizzy's waist.
I'm fine,
Nan retorted. She showed no signs of trauma from the kidnapping attempt. Affy wasn't sure she could be equally cool under those circumstances.
Besides, Haig can't climb. One of us should be here, so it's got to be me.
You take good care of him,
Wreath said. Nan smiled.
He returns the favor.
Enough flirtation theater. Affy refocused her attention on the tunnels that led to the lower rings. Unlike all the other tunnels, these showed signs of damage from their long years of disuse. While the other structure remained intact, vines and roots from the arboretum had grown down through them, turning what had been clear passageways into thick, thorny mazes deep in shadow. It wasn't anything Affy could have explored on her own. She'd have preferred it that way, in case more of the smuggler's code was written down there. However, the twisty tunnels were ominous enough that she could see the upside of having company along for the trip. Dez took the lead, lowering himself through the tunnel. Its gravity was on the fritz, which meant the pull was coming from the rings below. Luckily, the craggy roots served as a makeshift ladder. Affy gripped on tightly as she lowered herself down. For a few seconds, she was surrounded by both tree roots and a vast field of stars, a contrast that delighted her in its strangeness. No time to linger and enjoy it, though. The Mizzy above her was in a hurry to descend, so much so that he was cutting away vines to clear his path even farther. She heard the beeps and whines of a droid. Glancing upward, she saw an 8T scooting along, its treads gripping the outer wall of the tunnel. Huh, she thought. Those things are thorough. A snap echoed through the tunnel, and Wreath made a sound of discomfort. Peering down, Affy could see that his foot had gone straight through a slender root. No big deal. Or so Affy thought, until the 8T whirred past her toward Wreath, then hit him with an electric shock. Ow! Wreath shook his hand as though it stung. What the... The Mizzy yelped in pain. Affy looked up to see another 8T extending pincers toward the Mizzy, snapping at his fingers. Farther up the tunnel, at least three more 8Ts were descending toward them. She could hardly believe it, but there was no other explanation. We're being attacked! 9. What are they doing? Affy yelped, trying to swat back one of the 8Ts. It didn't matter. Another two were swarming in to take its place. I thought these droids were gardeners! Wreath readjusted his grip on the roots and steadied his balance. They are, but I guess that means they attacked threats to the garden. We did just cause some damage, Dez pointed out as he swung himself up through the snarl of vines to a place just below Wreath. I can see why they'd feel endangered. Nan's round cheeks were flushed. Both her arms were wrapped around the nearest thick root, but her legs dangled because the pincers of an 8T were snapping beneath her feet, keeping her from finding a steady perch. Are we going to keep talking about droid feelings, or can you stop these stupid things? Stay calm, Wreath said, which wasn't generally a helpful thing to say, at least not to someone currently hanging by her arms with swarms of attacking robots on the way. But it kept everybody quiet for a moment, giving Wreath a chance to think and center himself in the Force. It also gave the 8Ts a chance to assemble. Dozens of them were traveling down the tunnel's curved walls, their magnetic treads gripping so well that they might as well have been speeding along a flat surface. Although their dark bodies didn't show up well against the blackness of space, he could see them swarming by the way they blotted out the stars. Their tiny pruning claws, which not that long before had been cute, clicked and clacked ominously. Affy yelped as one of them clipped off the end of her long braided hair. If those pincers could slice through thick vines or slender tree branches, they'd cut through flesh and bone, too. Whatever long-ago zealot gardener had programmed these droids had done too good a job. Okay, Affy said, huffing as she pulled herself into a more secure position within the labyrinth of vines. This shouldn't be a problem.
You Jedi can fly, right? So just fly us out of here already.
Dez shook his head.
We can't fly. Some of us can levitate.
Same difference,
Affy insisted.
But it's a complicated thing to do, and difficult under stressful situations.
Dez finished as though she hadn't spoken. Affy made a face.
So you're telling me you can only fly when you don't need to? What good is that exactly?
Wreath couldn't help thinking she had a point.
Far beneath them, in the lower rings themselves, a strange light flickered, purplish, brilliant.
What was that? He asked.
Looks like some kind of an energy field,
Dez speculated.
There's something interesting down there, whatever it might be.
Let's figure that out once we're safe from the attack of the Killer Gardeners.
Affy's words were cut short with a yelp.
Ow! This vine has spines or something. It scraped me. We have bigger problems,
Nan said, seemingly through gritted teeth.
Than a scrape?
Dez said,
Everyone stay calm until I get to Nan, all right?
The safest place to move was in the direct center of the tunnel, but it was also the place with the fewest roots or vines to balance on. Anywhere safe to stand was also well within the AT's range. Dez nimbly climbed past Wreath to the place where Nan and the Mizzy clung to their feeble handholds. The AT's swarmed closer with each of his steps, but he never paused or even stopped smiling. Reaching out one hand, Dez summoned two of the vines from above, which writhed their way down into his waiting palm. Then he tossed one to the Mizzy and bent to gather Nan under his arm.
Follow me with Affy, okay, Wreath?
Got it,
Wreath called back. Dez nodded to the Mizzy, and on an unspoken count between them, they began to climb. The Mizzy managed so well that Wreath realized Dez was controlling their ascent. It was much easier to use the Force to help boost someone already climbing than to simply levitate them into thin air. So Wreath began working his way toward Affy, but so did the AT's. A full swarm had reached them. Affy winced as the droids crawled like beetles to the bend of the route that provided her fragile hold on the wall.
I can't believe I'm going to be taken out by severed astromech heads, she said, grabbing for her blaster. But at least I'm taking a few with me before I...
Affy, no! The idea came to Wreath in a rush.
Don't shoot the droids. Shoot the tree roots below us. The tree is not my problem.
But it will be the AT's problem. See? Understanding dawned. Affy half turned and fired downward at the lowest root she could possibly target. Her blaster ignited a small fire, which then set some moss ablaze. Small as the first flames were, it took only those wisps of smoke to set off the AT's alarms. The blinking blue lights along their bases turned red and they all rotated as one, swirling to get as close to the tree as possible. As Wreath had suspected, protecting the plants from fire took precedence over every other job an AT had, including pursuing vandals who'd intruded into the tunnels. While the droids sprayed small jets of water over the moss, easily dousing the fire, Wreath was able to reach Affy, who had already grabbed a vine. He expected her to climb up to the Arboretum level without him, but instead she reached out for help, which Wreath was glad to give. As she clung to his shoulders, Affy said, slightly winded,
I still think you should have let me shoot one. Next time.
Her grip slipped, and he managed to lower her before she fell. Wreath expected her to laugh off her clumsiness and to right herself immediately. Instead, Affy staggered sideways, gripping one wrist.
I feel weird. That scrape from the vine, it hurts that much?
Wreath frowned.
Let me see it.
She started to hold out her hand, then slumped against the nearby wall and slid down to the floor. The mark on her wrist was already raised and livid, and streaks spread through it in ominous shades of purple and black. Poison. Orla paced through the center of the Arboretum globe. At the moment, every other being docked at the Amaxine station had somewhere else to be, whether that was their own ships or the station's lower ring.
This gave her a chance to study the strange idols they'd found on board. Unease rippled through her as she approached the statues, that ominous sense of warning emanating from them as surely as light from a flame. Maybe understanding what they were looking at would help determine exactly what this vague warning meant. She stood face to face with the humanoid queen, the first of the idols to turn up. To Orla's amusement, she realized that they resembled each other somewhat. Strong cheekbones, thick brows, proud bearing. However, the stark simplicity of Orla's white robes contrasted with the ornately carved and jeweled raiment of this long-ago ruler. Although Orla wasn't the scholar Comac Vitus was, she had her own gifts to bring to this analysis. Her connection to the Force was instinctive, almost primal. She trusted it to steer her. Sometimes pre-existing knowledge stood in the way of discovery, putting boundaries on thought. This, she suspected, might be one of those times. With all his learning, Comac had studied these idols already and found only intriguing clues, no truths.
Let's give instinct a try.
Orla stared at the dark red jewel that sat topmost in the idol's crown. She let her mind fall into a kind of trance, not full meditation, but a deep concentration that allowed random thoughts to rise to the surface. The practice gave the subconscious a chance to be heard.
A queen, mighty and defiant.
That much seemed inarguable. Well, mighty was inarguable. Why had defiant come to mind?
When are we defiant? When we are opposed.
Orla studied the queen's lifted chin, comparing it to the rest of her bearing. The queen's hands did not hold weapons. Instead, a kind of scimitar lay at her feet. She had been forged not with her arms held high in some kind of salute or bearing plundered treasure. Her arms remained at her sides, with coiled bracelets around each wrist.
Bracelets?
Orla asked herself in a flash of insight.
Or chains.
It suddenly seemed so clear to her that she was shocked she hadn't seen it before. The idols didn't represent leaders or gods. They represented the vanquished, representatives of the forces, civilizations, planets, who'd been conquered by whoever built the statues.
So,
she muttered,
who the hell were they?
Zaituin had taught Dez a lot about poisons. The Zait royalty were made up of treacherous houses, forever attempting to assassinate one another by elaborate means, such as powders added to wine glasses or venoms smeared on pillowcases. Dez recognized the black streaks spreading across Affy's skin even before she'd fully passed out.
Come on, he said, scooping her up in his arms. A medpack will take care of this, but we've got to get to it right away.
Dez raced for the vessel. Wraith ran so fast he passed them, which was good. He could get the med pack ready. Already, Affy's skin had turned sallow, and the color had drained from her lips.
I've got it!
Wraith reached the airlock mere seconds before Dez would have run through it with Affy. Instead, he kneeled down, bracing the girl. Within moments, Wraith dashed back out with a med pack in hand. Right behind him was Leox Jossi.
Whoa, what's wrong with Little Bit?
Nothing this won't fix.
Dez pressed the anti-tox booster against her skin. That hiss and click had rarely been more welcome. Sure enough, after only a few moments, the dark streaks on her skin began fading, and Affy's breaths deepened. Leox dropped to his knees in relief and put one hand on Affy's head. She stirred, opening her eyes.
What was that?
A vine scraped you,
Dez said.
Apparently, it was poisonous.
Great,
Affy muttered.
That's just what we needed on this station on top of everything else. Something poisonous.
The fun never stops.
Leox's grin could have lit up any midnight.
Come on, girl. Let's get some Jetta tea in you.
Dez let Leox take Affy back into the ship. Wraith remained behind with him.
We should tag those vines, maybe.
I don't see lots of them around, thankfully.
Dez stretched his arms above his head, grateful to move freely after the confines of the tunnel.
But yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Wreath hesitated as though there was something he wanted to say to Dez, or maybe more like there was something he definitely didn't want to say but couldn't help thinking about.
Hey,
Dez said gently.
Out with it.
Out with what?
Out with whatever's been weighing you down since we met up at the spaceport.
Wreath leaned against one of the nearby trees, studying Dez with a startlingly adult expression. Or not so startling. Wreath was nearly of age, even if Dez still thought of him as the youngling excited to have been chosen by Master Jorah. Their friendship had to grow along with Wreath into something more equal and more meaningful.
I can't believe you chose to come to the frontier,
Wreath finally said.
Of all the places you could have gone, even Zaituwin.
Zaituwin was endless petty bickering and plotting with next to no action.
Dez rubbed his head, warding off the memories of all the headaches that world had caused him.
At least after the first months, once we'd quieted some of the unrest. Once that was over, I didn't do anything of real significance. On the frontier, there's a chance to act.
I guess I should be more like you,
Wreath said.
I know I need to embrace this assignment, any assignment the Council gives us. But I'm not drawn to action the same way you are.
Dez confessed what he'd hardly admitted to himself.
Sometimes I think I crave action and excitement too much. It can be dangerous, you know.
So Master Jorah says.
But Wreath didn't sound as though he believed it. He sounded as if he was judging himself and falling short. So Dez rose and put a hand on Wreath's shoulder.
Listen, the Force is about balance, right? Ideally, it's about finding balance within each and every individual Jedi. But that's not the same as finding balance within the Order, which is just as important. We need knights who crave adventure and knights who don't seek it out. Each individual brings different gifts to the Jedi Order. Our job is to appreciate the value of those gifts, including your own.
Wreath gave him a lopsided grin.
Okay, I'll try.
Good, Dez said, inwardly adding,
I'll try too.
Hey, Dez, I have this one question.
Okay, hit me.
Did Master Jorah ever ask you... Do you know why no Jedi can cross the Kyber Arch alone?
Dez frowned.
No, she never asked me that. And people cross it alone all the time. It's not like some insurmountable challenge, just meditative practice, like walking a labyrinth.
I know! Wreath breathed out in frustration. But Master Jorah insists nobody can cross that archway alone, and she wants me to tell her why.
I've got nothing.
Dez shrugged.
All I can tell you is Master Jorah is wiser than both of us put together. If she's given you a riddle to solve, it's worth solving.
Later, once she'd gotten herself cleaned up and freshened up and returned to the cockpit, Affy was disgruntled.
You're defending the ATs?
They're gardeners, Leox said, stretched out in his chair, feet propped on the cockpit console. His eyes were closed, as though he could chat and nap at the same time. Maybe he could.
Stewards of the soil, you threaten their very reason for being.
Affy sighed and let it go. Of course, the droids were only following their programming. Didn't mean she had to like them. Besides, she had more important things to tell Leox.
Listen,
she began.
Out there on the station, up in the higher rings, I found some lines written in code.
Code? Leox didn't open his eyes.
Tell me more.
It looks like some kind of smuggler's code. Handwritten symbols that give them hints about directions they can travel through hyperspace, that kind of thing.
Leox finally turned his head and looked at her.
Why would they write that down instead of recording it the usual way?
I don't know,
Affy said, flexing her still sore wrist.
They just did.
That question wasn't rhetorical. Think about it. Hardly anybody actually writes symbols with their hands anymore. Not anywhere in the galaxy, so far as I know. At least, not on planets advanced enough to have technology. So why are space pilots scribbling important information on the walls? It felt good to have the answer even before he was finished with the question.
Because they're skimming stuff off the top and hiding it from Scover.
Leox sat up straight then, his beads swaying back into place.
Wait, how does Scover come into it?
One of the symbols is this.
Affy pointed to the star shape on her coverall pocket.
It's got to be pilots in the Bind Guild talking to each other, but in a way and in a place my a place Scover doesn't know about.
He weighed her words for a few long moments. Affy couldn't wait to see him light up with the same astonishment and anger she'd felt. If only Geode were there instead of recrystallizing in his bunk. She wanted her discovery witnessed and confirmed. But then Leox shook his head.
Not much goes on in the guild that Scover Bind doesn't know.
Of course not, but she can't know about this.
Why can't she?
Leox's pale blue eyes met Affy's with unaccustomed directness.
The coordinates for this station were pre-programmed into the vessel as part of the standard nav download every ship gets when joining the guild. That's not coincidence.
Frustration tugged at Affy's temper.
Why couldn't he see this? These thieves inside the guild, they could have tampered with the download, put in the information they'd need to operate behind Scover's back,
and share it with every single new ship in the guild, even if they're not part of this so-called conspiracy?
Affy folded her arms across her chest. So how do you explain it?
Leox took several moments before he answered, his voice low and patient.
I know and you know that not every guild hall is what you would call, in the strictest sense, legal. Scover's got plenty to hide from the authorities. This seems like a pretty good place to hide it.
She wouldn't hide it from me,
Affy insisted. There was no reply. Leox just gazed at her, his expression melancholy and yet kind. It was the kindness that infuriated Affy the most. The idea that she needed kindness, that she was some simple, gullible fool Scover coddled and humored instead of a true pilot and guild official in her own right.
So many other pilots looked down on her. Leox never did.
Or at least, he never had, not until that moment. Without another word, she stalked off the bridge, half hoping Leox would follow her to apologize, but he let her go. Orla Jereni watched Affy storm down the vessel's main corridor, practically trailing black smoke from her rage. Through the cockpit door, Orla caught a glimpse of Leox watching her go, concern written all over his sun-bronzed face.
Not a good time for a chat, she decided.
For the moment, Orla had little else to do. She didn't intend to venture back toward the ancient idols until Komak could go with her. Dez was still strategizing a new way to penetrate the lower rings of the station, and Wreath was handling things with the fellow refugees, most particularly Nan, it seemed. Orla still hoped to have a conversation about spacecraft purchasing, but Affy and Leox appeared to be distracted at the moment. As for Geode, well, a Ventian probably had different needs for a spaceship than a humanoid would. Orla had to put that conversation on hold. Besides, she and Komak had plenty to talk about besides the idols. Orla found him on the vessel's observation deck, a grandly titled meter of corridor that happened to have a small window. Komak saw her enter but didn't speak.
You've got your hood up again,
she said.
Never a positive sign.
Generally, she got Komak to sigh within 5 minutes. This time, she'd had him right off the bat.
I suppose asking for privacy on this ship is futile.
Oh, I don't know about that. What is futile is expecting old friends not to understand when you're having trouble.
The many problems on this station...
Spare me,
she said, not unkindly.
What I'm talking about has been hanging over you since long before the hyperspace disaster.
Komak and Orla's bond had formed during their Padawan years because of the Irem Arano hostage crisis. The mistakes they'd made then, not being cautious enough about responding to signals, not doing enough research before diving into action, had been redeemed at a terrible price. Sometimes she reminded herself to see the good that had come from it all. If the mission had turned out any other way, would that part of the galaxy ever have trusted the Republic, much less chosen to join it? Would Starlight Beacon have been built? Orla doubted it. Still, neither she nor Komak could look back on those events without regrets. That was something Orla understood without having to ask. They'd grown up to be two very different individuals, but their bond endured and always would. Orla knew her decisions to become a Wayseeker might separate her from many in the Jedi Order, not from Komak.
"I've never kept secrets from you," he admitted.
"You've tried," Orla said. "I just never let you get away with it."
"Don't remind me."
She intended to remind him at regular intervals throughout their lives, but she could drop it for a day.
"Are you going to make me interrogate you?"
"Do you have to?"
Komak's dark eyes searched hers.
"Coming back here, on our way to a place so close to Arano and Irem, finding ourselves imperiled again, having to guess at the dangers that lie ahead."
"It's a very different situation," Orla hastened to say.
The vibrations of that long-ago event were strong enough without delving deeply into it. She wasn't sure she was ready to bear that.
"I sense that there will be further parallels," Komak said. "There are other resonances all around us. Their forms remain unclear, but before this mission is over, we will see them true."
"Got it."
No mystic, Orla figured it was time to change the subject, but then she felt it. The same shiver of terrible cold that had seized her before, the same bleak place so far away.
"Komak!"
she called, but he couldn't hear her. They were both lost in the petrifying vision. Wreath strolled along the perimeter of the Arboretum level, almost idly, as if he weren't keeping a sharp eye on the Mizzi, the Arinkens, and some of the others who'd tried looting earlier. He personally would have waited longer to allow everyone to board freely again, but this was not a point on which he felt comfortable challenging a master. While Leox had ably calmed them down, and the tunnels to the lower rings provided their own deterrence to entry, it seemed possible that a loner from any of the groups might try something. If they took some equipment from the station, Wreath honestly didn't care. Anybody who needed spaceship parts badly enough to pilfer centuries-old ones could have them. But if they stole one of the ancient idols, they'd just sell it for the precious metals or jewels without even bothering to study it. Sacrilege. Worst of all would be another kidnapping attempt. Wreath again remembered the moment his lightsaber had severed the man's arm, the faint thump through the blade that told him he'd hit and destroyed bone. He shuddered. Dez's kind words had helped, but this wasn't something he could ever totally put behind him. The act of attacking another person with a lightsaber was horrifying, and Wreath hoped it would always remain so.
"Let me never forget," he thought, "that it is another living creature standing opposite my blade." He looked up into the dark forest arches within the atrium. They were gone. Everything was gone. Wreath stood alone amid the plants and trees, but not the same ones. Or were they just altered somehow? His lightsaber in his hand already ignited. Slithering, rustling sounds filled the air on every side, setting him on edge. Fog, almost steamy in the sudden heat, coiled around him. Wreath looked around wildly, trying to understand how the scene had changed. Had he been transported to another part of the station? To another planet? Or had he somehow failed to see the true danger around him all that time? Ahead of him, he knew, lay the greatest threat of all. Wreath didn't understand how he knew it,
but he was as certain of it as anything else he'd ever known in his life. He shifted his body into battle stance, took a deep breath, and tried to brace himself against the threat he couldn't see. Then, amid the fog, only steps in front of him, came a sudden streak of blue light. A lightsaber blade. One that would be used to kill him. Ten. Stumbling forward through the fog, Reef called out, "Why are you doing this?" That would fix it. No Jedi would willingly harm another. The other Jedi would come close enough to see Reef, realize that they weren't enemies, and put away his weapon. Reef was so certain of it that his muscles relaxed slightly, ready to declare the emergency a false alarm. Instead, the figure jumped forward at a speed that rendered him, her, it, nothing but a blur. Reef had no time to focus on his attacker before a booted foot hit him squarely in the chest, knocking him to the ground. He gasped for breath that wouldn't come. He tried to push himself up, only to sink his hands deeply into warm, oozing mud. A lightsaber's hum made his ears prick and sent a shiver along his skin. It wasn't his own blade. That one had been knocked away from him, so it had to be his opponent's, rising overhead and then slashing down. And nothing. Reith found himself on all fours on the floor of the space station, surrounded by nothing more ominous than ferns and a couple of contented AT droids. His heart pounded with adrenaline, his whole body still on edge for a fight that was no longer happening or had never happened. Reith stood up, took a deep breath, and brought his awareness back to his body. Normally, he would have called on the Force to center himself, but not now. They were surrounded by darkness. A darkness that sought to terrify and confuse the Jedi. To judge by the vision Reef had just had, it also sought to turn them against each other. The tiny communications area had become the place for the Jedi to confer and plan. Orla wished they'd chosen differently, maybe someplace without a low, arched ceiling, someplace she could actually have stood upright. But the vessel offered few options, and at least this way, she, Comac, and Reith had to huddle together, which she found comforting. Long-limbed Dez stood in the doorway, which, if not comforting, was probably more comfortable for him. "We know the following," she said, counting off points on her long fingers. "Darkness resides within this station. It has a very different feel from the kind normally sensed from plants deep in the dark side. This means we cannot determine its source." Comac nodded. His gaze looked into the middle distance, someplace known but unseen.
"We've all sensed that these warnings are emanating from the idols. From their appearance, they are almost certainly not original to the station. Therefore, the idols were placed here later for some significant reason. Orla theorizes that they represented conquered peoples, which, if true, adds another factor for us to consider. Sealing some defeated darkness within these idols, and setting some kind of psychic warning upon that seal, that could explain it. Of course, this is only a possibility."
Orla shrugged.
"Let's call it a working hypothesis."
Reith leaned forward, wordlessly asking for permission to speak, which was given.
"The Force emanates from life, not from inanimate objects. There are legends of powerful Force artifacts created by the ancient Sith, but the Sith wouldn't have imprisoned darkness, surely. They'd have set it free."
"You assume," Comac replied, "that because every such artifact we know of has its origin in the Jedi or the Sith, that only Jedi or Sith could create one. We cannot make such assumptions. Others have possessed that power in the Force."
Orla considered the possibilities.
"So what do we do? Continue to ignore their warnings? Because those warnings are intense."
"Ignoring them would be dangerous,"
Comac agreed, steepling his fingers together.
"If the idols contain and warn against darkness, then that darkness must be examined, imprisoned even more thoroughly."
They're already pretty isolated out here, said Dez from the place in the doorway where he stood. On a station nobody much travels to, in an obscure corner of space.
Not necessarily, Komak replied. Afi has indicated that some traders currently use it from time to time. It wouldn't be surprising if the station were soon reclaimed by even more travelers. All the more reason to act.
I can't see any harm to the station in removing the idols,
Orla said.
There's nothing else here but some plants and some gardener droids. So let's test the hypothesis,
she said.
How?
Dez asked.
One of two ways,
Orla said.
Either we try to move and isolate the statues, or we destroy them.
But we can't destroy them. They're ancient artifacts,
Wreath protested.
They're history.
Orla gave him a look.
More to the point, if we destroy something that turns out to be a containment system for the dark side, we wind up setting the darkness loose. So I vote for the first option.
Dez frowned.
There's another possibility, one we haven't even investigated properly yet. What if the darkness that's confusing our minds is linked to whatever's protected by the energy field in the station's lower rings?
They all exchanged glances. Everyone had thought about this, but apparently with varied conclusions. Wreath appeared deeply doubtful, while Komak had the look of someone relieved to hear sense for a change. Orla considered herself open to whatever possibility, but not to endless debate. Time to do something.
Then we test that hypothesis too, she said. But first, you have to figure out how to get down there without being scraped by poisonous vines and without Aetes pruning you to death.
That made everyone chuckle as Orla had intended. Good. Laughter made people relax and smile. It cast the dark side away and brought them closer to the light. Wreath could hardly have blamed Afi, Nan, and the Mizzy if they refused to have anything else to do with the station's lower rings, even if they had managed to pull up the poisonous vines, gently so as not to disturb the Aetes, and cast them harmlessly to the side. However, all three of them rejoined the group to make the next attempt.
There's got to be something good down there,
Nan reasoned as she rechecked her field utility belt, glancing up just once to smile at Wreath.
No way I'm letting you guys have it all.
The Mizzy nodded in agreement, the difference being, in Wreath's opinion, that Nan was joking with him, but the Mizzy was completely serious. Afi was harder to get a read on. Her attention seemed only half-focused on the task at hand.
So what's our plan? We have a plan, right? Better than the last one?
Let's say we have a plan to make a plan,
Dez began.
Specifically, let's do recon. Do a more thorough survey of this level and see if we can find any potential points of entry besides the main tunnel and so on, without setting off the Aetes this time.
That would be preferable,
said the Mizzy straight-faced. It was really the only next step. But Wreath couldn't stop himself from wondering whether they couldn't take what they'd learned last time and use it tactically. Master Jorah always said, if you use your defeat to learn the path to victory, it was no defeat at all. Everyone shifted, about to disperse. Before they'd begun, though, Wreath blurted out,
I have an idea. It's either really good or completely ludicrous. If it's ludicrous, it's probably great.
Afi's enthusiasm had been renewed.
I've learned that working with Leox and Geode.
No doubt. Wreath turned to Dez.
The Aetes are programmed to attack any threats to the plants on this station, right?
Sure looks like it.
Dez rested his hands on his hips.
What's this about, Wreath?
Watch.
Wreath went to one of the smaller plants on the station, a budding yellow flower in a fist-sized round container. Many of them lined the walkways. The containers seemed to operate as makeshift nurseries for the Aetes. Gently, he eased the container from the soil. As he brushed away some of the dirt, a handful of Aetes swiveled to stare at Wreath. This behavior was clearly suspect. Very carefully, he tucked the flower's container into the folds of his robe jacket,
then snugly tied the belt around it. His knot was so secure that he could have done an acrobatic flip in the air without bruising a single petal. The AT stared for another second or so before turning to go about their business.
"There," he said. "They realize this doesn't count as damaging the plants. And if we wear these on our mission, they won't attack us," Nan said. "Because hurting us would mean hurting the flowers."
Dez grinned too, and even the Mizzy nodded. Affy, however, folded her arms.
"So you're saying that we're taking plants as hostages, using them as body shields?"
When she put it that way, it sounded worse, but...
"Well, yeah. Ludicrous," Affy said.
The smile she'd hidden so well before finally shone.
"And great."
Within a few minutes, each member of the party was wearing their own flower. The ATs found them more interesting now that they wore plants, but otherwise took no actions as they made their way back to the tunnel and began their descent.
"Now, for that energy field."
Dez stared at the flickering purplish light.
"Nothing to do but get down there and take a closer look."
"Agreed."
Reith started the climb down, followed by the others. To his dismay, the ATs whirred closer and started down the tunnel walls again. Dez swore under his breath.
"Looks like they'll sacrifice a few flowers for the greater good."
"By the greater good, you mean killing us?"
"That's what they mean by it, I think."
But Dez was wrong. The ATs swarmed along the tunnel walls all the way down to the very edge of the lower ring, extended various tools, and then, in the next instant, the purplish light disappeared.
"The droids turned the energy field off for us," Reef said in wonder, "to make sure we wouldn't fry the plants."
Dez actually waved at the ATs.
"Don't worry,"
he said, patting the planter that rested against his chest.
"We'll bring them back safe and sound."
Were the droids relieved? Plotting revenge? Reith didn't know and couldn't care. Not when they'd finally reached the last, most secret part of the Amaxine station. Once Affy had clambered into the lower rings, she felt vaguely let down. It wasn't all that different from the upper rings. Same tile work, same rails, except that it was entirely devoid of plant life, and she didn't yet see any signs of Smuggler's Code on the walls. Yet. The ring that welcomed them was very narrow. Other curving corridors, yet unexplored, must have made up the rest of the circumference. Without the purple glow of the energy field, the only illumination came from the station above. Still, they had glow rods, so that was enough light to search by.
"So, let's split up," Affy suggested. "Check different passageways on our own."
"Could you be any more obvious?" she scolded herself. But apparently nothing about her suggestion struck Dez or Reith as suspicious.
"Sure,"
Dez said.
"Doesn't seem like there's anything too dangerous down here. Might as well cover ground as quickly as possible."
Affy nodded like that was exactly what she'd been thinking. Finally, they broke up, and she was free to delve into one of the passageways by the light of her glow rod. Affy wondered whether she'd find codes, whether the other would, too, and whether they'd be able to make sense of them as quickly as she had. Sure enough, after the first bend, the first lines of writing appeared. She went right up to them, eager to translate as best she could. Above all, she hoped to find something that would vindicate her mother and prove to Leox that there was a corrupt element at work within the guild.
"There,"
she whispered. Her fingers touched the metal just next to the star symbol of the Bind Guild, still stark against the whitish background. This hadn't been written that long before. A decade at most, she'd guess. She tried to follow along, uncertain how to interpret the next few marks, until she came to a small drawing of a bird of prey, beak down, tail feathers up. Affy stared until the image seemed to be burning into her eyes. She recognized it immediately, but refused to believe that it could mean what it so clearly seemed to mean. There could be tons of other interpretations, she told herself. True.
But her parents, her biological parents, the ones she only dimly remembered but still dearly loved, their ship had been named the Kestrel's Dive. Whoever wrote this had been talking about her parents. That, or it had been written by her parents themselves. Reith's journey through another tunnel was shorter, or at least the part he took alone. It was darker down there, so much so that his glow rod seemed weaker. An optical illusion, surely, but a disquieting one. Every one of his footsteps sounded unnaturally loud as he ducked his head under the curved arches of the tunnel's beams. If plant life has taken over almost every other part of this station, Reith wondered, why did it never come down here? Was that energy field meant to protect what lies down here, or protect us from it? His passage and Dez's intertwined after only a few meters, with nothing but a handful of storage lockers and some scribbles on the wall to mark the significance of the spot.
Looks like we share the same destination, Dez said. Come on, let's check it out.
He felt a quiver of pride. What would his friends say, the ones who so idolized Dez Rydan? There they were, on a mission together, partners. Okay, Dez was possibly too excited about plunging into the dark unknown, but it was like Dez had said earlier. If some people disliked adventure, some others had to love it.
Look at this, Dez said.
He was gesturing at a circular door ahead. Its hinges were at top and bottom center, suggesting that it rotated to open.
That's weird. Why build it that way?
Could mean something. Could mean nothing.
Dez readjusted the planter cradled against his chest, making sure not to crease any of the leaves.
Come on, let's see if anything interesting is on the other side.
Reith reached out with the force, knowing Dez was doing the same. He sensed no sentience on the other side, no echoes of darkness.
Nothing alive, anyway.
So it would seem.
Dez walked ahead quickly, leaving Reith several paces behind.
Now, is this locked or...
The door flipped around, rotating on its central axis hinges so fast that it knocked Dez off his feet, spinning him around to the other side. Reith blinked, suddenly alone.
Whoa, Dez, turn that around!
It had actually looked pretty funny. Dez had enough of a sense of humor to appreciate that. But Dez wasn't laughing. He wasn't speaking. The door didn't flip again. Vibrations began to shudder through the floor, the walls. Through the thin slits of the doorway, stark white light beamed out so strong that Reith winced and lifted one hand to shield his eyes.
Dez?
A strange grinding sound, like engines or some other vast machinery began. Whatever was happening didn't sound good, and Dez Rydan was trapped in the middle of it. Dez shouted wordlessly, a sound that betrayed pain. Reith ran toward the door, ignoring the blinding light, and tried to force it open. But the hinges that had swung so easily before refused to budge. The light flared even brighter, so much so that Reith had to shut his eyes. Through his own eyelids, he saw a lacing of fragile veins and capillaries, silhouetted against dull red. In the next instant, it was dark. The vibration and sound had stopped. It took Reith a moment to recalibrate.
Dez, are you okay?
No reply. Reith pushed at the door once more without much hope. This time, it swung open immediately. The door was surprisingly heavy. The heft of it nearly knocked Reith down, the same as it had done to Dez. He could see into the tunnel, and it was narrow, thickly grooved. Dez was not inside. Carefully, Reith leaned in to get a better look. Still no Dez, but he glimpsed two helix rings, ancient but still unmistakable. Helix rings were incredible energy boosters, the equivalent of enough pure coaxium to fuel 40 or 50 large spaceships. They were seldom used because they generated too much power for almost any non-hyperspace purpose. They had a tendency to malfunction, especially when older, and created energy surges capable of melting metal,
blowing circuits, or disintegrating a human body down to the atoms. The first hint came with a wave of panic and sorrow, one so strong it pierced Comac's consciousness like a fine silver needle. He stood up in the cockpit, nearly knocking against Geode.
Something's wrong.
We live in an imperfect universe, said Leox, who was chewing on a stick of something that smelled minty. So that's a given.
I mean something's wrong with our people aboard the station, this moment.
Comac hurried toward the airlock. Leox was only a few steps behind. All his laid-back torpor had vanished at the first hint that Affy Hollow might be in trouble. They had only just made it into the leafy glade of the station when they were met by Nan, who was breathing hard and for some reason had a potted flower tucked into her pocket. Behind her, Comac could see the Mizzy hurrying toward his own people and Reith Silas emerging from the vines, his face white. Nan gasped out.
We heard this loud sound, but we didn't see... Reith's the only one who saw...
Saw what?
Comac resisted the urge to put his hands on the girl's shoulders. It would probably comfort a Padawan, but to Nan, it might come across as a threat.
Tell me.
Des is gone,
Nan whispered. Gone? What did that mean? He had traveled to another part of the station? Away from the station entirely? None of the docked ships had left. The vessel's sensors would have picked that up. Or did she mean... Affy was finally emerging from the trees near the tunnel. Leox called to her.
What's happened to Dez?
We don't know.
Her voice was strangely flat, as though she was in shock, which seemed strange to Comac. The young woman hardly knew Dez.
But it's not good.
Finally, Reith reached them. He brought his face slowly up to meet Comac's eyes. Everything about him radiated misery and grief. Already, Comac knew.
It has happened again. Just as it happened to Master Simix. The resonances warned me, but I did not see in time. This part of the galaxy has claimed its price.
Yet he still had to say the words.
Tell me how Dez fell.
The next few minutes were a blur of details that didn't make sense. Plants as hostages? But the gist remained the same.
Helix rings, Leox said gravely. And nothing left inside? That usually means...
He trailed off as he looked sidelong at Comac. No wonder. It was a difficult thing to say aloud. But it had to be said.
Vaporized, Comac said.
It came out evenly, a logical conclusion, no more.
The likeliest explanation is that Dez Rydan was vaporized instantly.
Affy had finally reached them, and somehow Comac had shocked her, as though she had been thinking of something else altogether. Affy said,
You mean he's dead?
Yes.
Comac reached out with a force, trying to find any scrap of the young Jedi's mind and spirit. He was answered with nothing but silence. It took Orla a few minutes to piece together exactly what had happened, getting her information only from the exhausted, shell-shocked Reith and Affy. Comac had already walked back through the length of the ship toward his bunk, declaring his intention to meditate. No doubt he was remembering Master Simix. Orla had her own grief to bear, but she'd always been able to put emotions aside until there was time to deal with them. Comac felt things more deeply and more immediately. His equilibrium was more difficult to maintain. Had there been anything to do, any immediate hope, Orla knew that Comac wouldn't have retreated. He, like the rest of them, would have done anything to get Dez back. But there was no such hope. Nothing to do but accept that a courageous, compassionate young man had been killed.
It would have been better if he died in battle,
Orla thought,
or during a rescue mission. Then his death would at least have had meaning. This? Some malfunctioning equipment on an ancient space station? It's so arbitrary, so unfair.
So was life.
All right,
Orla said to the assembled group, taking charge in Komak's place.
Is everyone else okay? No injuries?
No,
Wreath said, which seemed untrue given that he had severely bloodshot eyes and a stripe of sunburn along his forehead. But he was upright, moving and talking, so a radiation scan could wait until later. Affy looked like she was in shock, understandably enough. The Mizzy had gone back to his own people. Nan seemed completely unaffected, though she wore a saddened expression, probably out of consideration for the feelings of those who'd known Dez longer.
That little thing's sturdier than she looks,
Orla decided.
I wonder what she's seen out here. So nobody needs medical attention,
she said.
Okay, here's what I need you all to do. Wreath, Affy, clean yourselves up and rest for a few minutes. Nan, if you'd be good enough to explain this to the other refugees, it would be appreciated. And don't worry, that bastard with the red scarf is long gone.
Nan brightened, then realized her smile was inappropriate and squelched it.
And take these flowers back where they belong, would you? The ATs are hovering around the edge of the airlock. The last thing we need is an invasion.
I got that, said Leox, who had been standing quietly at the edge of the group.
He carefully took a small planter from Affy, who didn't look up at him once.
There are no good words to say,
Orla began.
We lost a good man and a great Jedi. We'll have to search for answers about what happened and soon. First, we owe him and ourselves a little while to reflect on who Dez Rydan was and to acknowledge his oneness with the Force.
The group broke up awkwardly, shuffling in various directions in silence. Orla put her head in one hand just long enough to take a few breaths. She couldn't allow herself the same time to reflect she'd granted Komak and Wreath. Not when she had to figure out what to do with the idols. Affy took a quick shower in the vessel's tiny head, waving the wand all over. The process had become strange, as if her body were now foreign to her. It seemed to live in another galaxy entirely, one she no longer inhabited and could only watch from a great silent distance. Afterwards, she knotted her long, dark brown hair back into a braid and put on a fresh coverall. Normally, this made her feel better, regardless of how she'd felt to begin with. Instead, her fingers kept finding the embroidery of the Bind Guild crest, tugging at the threads, but they never came loose. When she emerged from the head, Leox stood in the hallway waiting.
It's free,
she said dully.
Not my immediate concern. I'm more worried about you. Looks like you got run over by a stampede of Gundarks.
I went on a routine search and somebody died, she snapped. Am I supposed to throw a party?
Of course not, he said, maddeningly calm. But you've got a core of Durasteel. It takes more than that to knock you flat.
The Kestrel's Dive. Who would be writing about the Kestrel's Dive? Affy kept turning that over in her head. She'd interpreted other symbols as ships' names before, but she must have misunderstood something, because it had looked to her as if the pilots were writing about their own ships, which had to be impossible, because otherwise it meant that her parents had been there, on that very station. They wouldn't plot against Scover. I know they wouldn't. I hardly remember them, but I feel so sure.
I'm not going anywhere, Leox said.
What if I don't have a core of Durasteel?
Anger blazed within Affy, white hot, infusing her with renewed strength.
What if this is exactly enough to knock me flat? If I'm able to feel compassion for other people?
Leox held up his hands.
I'm not saying... Yeah, it's a hell of a thing, losing Dez. But there's more to it than that, isn't there?
No.
With that, she turned and walked away. Walking away from Leox, unfortunately, meant walking away from her cabin. It led toward the mess, though. If she grabbed a couple of nutrient bars that might tide her over for a day or more, she could hide in her bunk, seeing no one, saying nothing. That sounded good.
Affy walked into the mess to find Geode. He had more sense than to interrogate her. His silent sympathy broke through where no words ever could have. She leaned her head against Geode's side and let the tears come. Patiently, he waited with her as she cried, for a dozen reasons and none at all. Wreath waited until everyone else was preoccupied by grief, duty, or whatever else, then assembled his equipment pack. He prepared as though for a mountain expedition, with cables and clamps, and double-checked his lightsaber. Nobody noticed him leave the vessel and enter the station. He had the space to himself, it seemed. After what happened to Dez, nobody from the other refugee ships had any interest in exploring further. The only sounds were the whirring and beeping of droids. The ATs were placidly mulching as though nothing had happened. To them, he supposed, nothing had. Wreath found the small planter he'd put down earlier and placed it back within his pocket. Then he eased his way into the tunnel, going step by step, mindful of his own slow, steady breathing.
"Body and spirit as one,"
whispered Master Jorah's voice in his memory. His feet landed on the lower ring with a metallic thud. If anyone else were on the station, they'd have heard him for sure. Wreath was grateful he could keep this secret for a while. He found the exact curve they'd taken before, found the circular door. Opening it again seemed both foolhardy and necessary. Since he knew about the helix rings, he reasoned, he could avoid setting them off. Then Wreath froze as he saw through the small slits in the door a faint, flickering light. This wasn't the burning blaze that had forced his eyes closed when Dez had been lost. It was dimmer, smaller. It was also unfamiliar, unauthorized, and severely suspect. If someone was tampering with Dez's death scene, or if it turned out that this wasn't Dez's